That was Never in Your Sun by Stevie Wonder. I hope you've enjoyed this last hour of Preheated. This was the Oatmeal Cookie Edition. I'm your host, DJ Red Velvet, and we've got a tiny clip of one more song left to round off the hour. And yeah, I'll see you back here next Wednesday at 5 p.m. You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
We get it almost every night, and when that moon gets big and bright, it's supernatural delight. Every border was dancing in the moonlight. Everybody here is out of sight. They don't bark and they don't bite. They keep things loose, they keep things alive. Every border was dancing in the moonlight.
Dancing in the moonlight. Everybody's feeling warm and bright. It's such a fine and natural sight. Everybody's dancing in the moonlight.
We like our fun and we never fight. You can't dance and stay uptight. It's supernatural delight. Every border was dancing in the moonlight.
Dancing in the moonlight. Everybody's feeling warm and bright. It's such a fine and natural sight. Everybody's dancing in the moonlight.
Everybody.
With Dr. Fields Black about Harriet Tubman, so stay tuned for that. I will be live in the studio. Also, Rick will be with me. This week, we have In Black America and more news for you. So stay with us.
From KUT
and KUTX
Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
When I first went to the NFL, he unarmed me and took away all my excuses. And he said to me, right before I went to camp, he said, "Hey, Cat," he said, "it's time to play." He said, "But when you go, don't come back and say that it wasn't fair. You know before you leave it's not going to be fair. You got to be better." And he repeated that. And, you know, I took that with me. And when you say about the challenges, just to run through some of the challenges that I think that I had trying to play the position. First of all, there was no blacks playing anywhere. That was a challenge in itself. And then secondly, I was coming from the South. I never went to school or played with a white player.
James Shake Harris, the first African-American season-starting quarterback in NFL history. On February 8, 2024, during Super Bowl 58 week, the Fritz Pollard Alliance Foundation held its 19th annual Johnny L. Cochran Jr. Salute to Excellence Awards. The awards recognized the achievement and outstanding commitment of individuals and organizations dedicated to promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. This year, the awards luncheon features a discussion: the emergence of the African-American quarterback with former Pro Bowl MVP quarterback, front office executive, and the first African-American starting quarterback in NFL history, and the first to lead his team to the playoffs, James Shaq Harris and Doug Williams, current front office executive, and the first African-American Super Bowl MVP selected quarterback in NFL history. The discussion also included Commissioner Roger Goodell. I'm Johnny L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the emergence of the African-American quarterback in Black America.
There's not one time that Shaq came back and said that how tough it was in the NFL. All he ever told me is, and Coach Rob used to say, is blocking and tackling. And whatever you do at Grambling, you can do it at the next phase. And, you know, when I left Grambling, I was on with the fact that it's about, I'm going to go back to Coach Robinson. He had one word, and it was about opportunity. And, you know, with me, and just like say to Shaq, he said, hey, Cat, hell, you just got to show him. And when I left Grambling, that was the most important thing to me. You know, I went to Tampa, and we all know, you know, at that time, 1978, Shaq had played. Eldridge Dickey had been drafted as the first black quarterback, but never got an opportunity to play that position.
Consider this. 15 years after the Supreme Court overturned segregation and 50 years after the NFL was founded, and a full year before the NFL-AFL merged, in 1969, James Shaq Harris became the first African-American quarterback to start a season opener in the NFL. In 2001, Michael Vick was the first African-American quarterback to be selected number one overall in the NFL draft. The first African-American quarterback to win NFL MVP was Steve McNair in 2003. And in 2006, Warren Moon was the first African-American quarterback enshrined in football's Hall of Fame. Patrick Mahomes is the youngest player ever to win an NFL MVP, a Super Bowl MVP, and a Super Bowl. He was 24 when he first achieved that. He is the third player ever to win three Super Bowl Most Valuable Player awards, and he is the third player ever to be named Super Bowl MVP in consecutive seasons. At this year's 19th annual Johnny L. Cochran Jr. Salute to Excellence Awards, a conversation took place regarding the emergence of the African-American quarterback. The discussion was moderated by former NFL executive Michael Hugh. The participants were James Shaq Harris, Doug Williams, and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell.
Thanks so much, Michelle. We have a really interesting program. I'm going to have our guests come on up. It's a conversation about the black quarterback. And people have talked about it in the past, but the irony of today is that we have really the pioneers of what the black quarterback has been in the modern era. And we're going to have an open and candid conversation about how that's had an impact not only today, but what it means in terms of diversity hiring in the future. And so we're excited to have our guests here, James Shaq Harris, who I'll introduce. Let's give him a round of applause.
Shaq.
The infamous Doug Williams. And Commissioner Roger Goodell. They didn't really want me to give you their bios, and they're all about 3 pages long, so keeping the program going. But it'll be a conversation that we'll just have about it, and it should feel a little bit like you're invited in on a private conversation, almost eavesdropping. But in this case, we've invited you in. So hopefully you'll enjoy it, and we'll just kick it off and get started. I'm going to start with James Shaq Harris. The story of pioneers in the NFL, as I mentioned, is really amazing. And Shaq has had an interesting career. Let me just tell you a little bit about him. He and Doug Williams co-founded the Black Hall of Fame. He was drafted by the Buffalo Bills in 1973. And let me just tell you a few of the firsts that he accomplished. He was the first black quarterback to start a season opener in the modern era. He was the first black quarterback to start and win a playoff game. He was the first black quarterback to be selected to and win the MVP for the Pro Bowl. Some pretty impressive credentials. When you think about the story of the black quarterback and the time that you were in the game, obviously there were a lot of obstacles you had to overcome in that time frame. What were those challenges like and how did you overcome them?
I'd have to start with preparation and mental and physical, and that's both mental and physical. And it would have to start with Coach Robinson. And when I first went to the NFL, he unarmed me and took away all my excuses. And he said to me right before I went to camp, he said, hey, Cat, he said, it's time to play. He said, but when you go, don't come back and say that it wasn't fair. You know before you leave it's not going to be fair. You got to be better. And he repeated that. And, you know, I took that with me. And when you say about the challenges, just to run through some of the challenges that I think that I had trying to play the position. First of all, there was no blacks playing anywhere. That was a challenge in itself. And then secondly, I was coming from the South. I never went to school or played with a white player. And I had very little conversation. And one of my first, I was number 7th on the depth chart with 2 former All-Pros. And they were going at their pace. There was no way for me to keep up. And my first responsibility was to go in the huddle and call the play. And it was uncomfortable because all the linemen were white. Just to run through some things, during those days you had to call your own plays. There was hate mail. There was death threats. You know, and there was the fact of trying to play perfect. And 25 days of camp, and they were cutting every day and knocking on the door, you knew that the next day you could get cut. But the thing I'm most proud of is all the people who supported me, fans from all around the country who supported me in terms of giving me an opportunity to play, John Rauch. And I was able to become the starting quarterback and the first to start in the National Football League. I was very proud of that. But the one thing that's always stuck with me the most is all the players who was denied the opportunity to play quarterback because of the color of their skin. And I'm so proud of the players playing today, but I feel blessed because I felt I was representing something special with all the people who cheered for me.
You know, Doug, you both went to, that's worth a round of applause. Doug, you both went to Grambling and played under Coach Rob. Your name, no offense to Shaq, is probably more prominently associated with the success of the black quarterback. You were drafted in the first round, first black quarterback to do that. And then, of course, in 1988, when you had the opportunity to step in and play both in the playoffs and the Super Bowl, and not only be the first black quarterback to play in a Super Bowl, but to win a Wheaties box noteworthy MVP appearance, and went on to have great success. How did you and Shaq together work through those struggles, both of you playing that position and one of the few black quarterbacks in the NFL?
Well, number one, let me say this. I probably was, as Coach Rob used to always say, hell, he's the most blessed man in America. And I think I got him beat on that because I had Coach Robinson, I had James Harris, and I had my oldest brother, Robert Williams, to be able to navigate through all the things that was out there. And not one time, you know, James and all the other guys used to come back to Grambling during spring practice and, you know, just talk to the players and stuff like that. It's not one time that Shaq came back and said that how tough it was in the NFL. All he ever told me is, and Coach Rob used to say, is blocking and tackling. And whatever you do at Grambling, you can do it at the next phase. And, you know, when I left Grambling, I was on with the fact that it's about, I'm going to go back to Coach Robinson. He had one word, and it was about opportunity. And, you know, with me, and just like you say to Shaq, he said, hey, Cat, hell, you just got to show him. And when I left Grambling, that was the most important thing to me. You know, I went to Tampa, and we all know, you know, at that time, 1978, Shaq had played. Eldred Dickey had been drafted as the first black quarterback, but never got an opportunity to play that position. And I knew that. And in Tampa, you know, a lot of things, a lot of, like Shaq say, hate mail and stuff. But to me, the most important thing was the players on the field, the coaching staff. You know, I was fortunate to have John McKay, who understood playing with a black quarterback because he did it in 68 with Jimmy Jones, you know, back at USC. So it wasn't no thing to him, but I had guys like that, Kenny Herock, and Coach Gibbs was my, like I tell all guys, I knew Coach Gibbs before the guys in Washington knew Coach Gibbs because he coached my rookie year there. And Coach Gibbs was probably my saving grace in Tampa because every day after practice, I went home with Coach Gibbs every day, you know, and ate dinner with his 2 sons, bless their soul, and his wife every night. And when we ate dinner, they went to bed. Coach Gibbs and I stayed up. And then he got back in his car and drove me back to the hotel we were staying. So I did that the whole training camp. And that's what got me through with the teammates on my team and the coaches. Like I say, I was able to navigate all that thing during that time.
Well, Roger Goodell's not a black quarterback, but...
I thought I was yesterday.
As commissioner of the NFL since 2006, he's had some pretty legacy-worthy accomplishments. Let me just cite a few. Over $110 billion television deal over the current CBA. Franchise valuations approaching almost $10 billion. Over 250 million fans globally that are NFL fans. International growth of the game all throughout Europe. And TV viewership that is indisputably making the NFL the number one product on television. But equally important to that is single-handedly leading the campaign for diversity hiring in the National Football League. And having had the benefit of working with his staff that he's put together, Dacia Smith and Jonathan Bean and Belinda Lerner that are here and other folks, they've done a tremendous job leading this campaign. But I guess my question is, Commissioner, with all of the things that you've done in your career and thinking about your legacy over these 16, 17 years as commissioner, why has diversity hiring been so important to you?
Well, first off, I just want to reinforce what you just said about Dacia and Jonathan Bean and so many others in our office. It wasn't done just by me, believe me. And I include our clubs in that. Our clubs have taken diversity very seriously. I think they recognize the value of that. And I think it goes to the core of your question. To me, diversity makes us so much better. It gives us an ability to bring in greater talent. It gives us a better perspective. We understand issues more deeply, and I think that's been helpful for us making better decisions, you know, at the league level as well as the club level. To me, I think that's what's most encouraging right now. I'm up here with these two legends, and we're running out of first, which is a good thing. And so that, to me, makes this is more normal. And, you know, we had last year, Doug sat with me at the Super Bowl, where we had two black quarterbacks for the first time. That can't happen for the first time again. So this is progress, and we just got to continue. We still have a lot of work to do.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message. And now back to this episode of In Black America.
Thank you very much. We've had this event for, I think, 14, 15 years. It's our 19th, maybe, anniversary. Commissioner Goodell's been at every one of these Johnny Cochran Salute to Excellence luncheons. So the commitment has always been there. But I wanted to pick up on the point about the two black quarterbacks in the last Super Bowl. And, of course, the draft this past year where three black quarterbacks were taken in the first four selections. And this year, another prominent quarterback from USC has the potential to be the number one pick in the draft. Let me start with you, James. What is it that you think has driven so much increase now in the black quarterback position? And why are there so many more black players in college and in the NFL, do you think?
I think it starts in high school. There was a time where most of the black quarterbacks were the best athletes on the high school team, which meant that they would be switched to wide receiver, running back. Today, those same high school quarterbacks, well, they're getting an earlier start, they're going to camps, they're being coached up, the fundamentals of the game, they're being taught the passing game, terminology, and when they get to high school, by being the best athlete on the team, now they're familiar with how to throw the football. Before, you know, they were athletes, and now we're getting quarterbacks. And when you look at the game today, the quarterbacks today in the National Football League, they're field general. They know the game. They're great ambassadors, you know, for our league. And their message is strong to all the young kids in the next generation. And you can see by the results are they're some of the highest paid in terms of, and we had two in the Super Bowl last year. We got Mahomes back this year. But the biggest thing that's happening to our game is the quarterbacks that's extending plays, winning first downs, and winning games, you know, for the NFL.
You know, Doug, you talked about opportunity. There are 42 starting quarterbacks in college football this year, and 20 of which are in the Power Five conference. Again, How do you see opportunity as playing a role in that in terms of so many more black quarterbacks being visible?
Well, I think like Shaq just said, you know, it was a time when you was in high school, you was the best athlete. And then now when you go to college, being that athlete, you get a chance to play that position because I think a lot of mindsets has changed over the years. You know, it was a time where, you know, when you went to a certain place, college, what have you, you know, no matter how good you were in high school, you was going to end up being a wide receiver, defensive back, or what have you. But now I think the coach's mindset is a little different, that you can win with that athlete, that guy who's learned how to play that position. And I think that in itself speaks volume for the guys that are coming out now because, you know, in order to win, your quarterback got to be mobile and agile. Yeah. Because what has happened over the last few years on defense has transpired that you've got to be able to move. If you can't move in the pocket, 9 out of 10, you just a sitting duck. You know, fortunately, guys like Brady and Peyton Manning over the years was able to navigate that pocket better than anybody. They know when to move, how to move, and where to move and get the ball out of their hand. Every quarterback can't do that. And now if you don't do that today, the chance of you playing quarterback at the next level, it's not going to happen.
Commissioner, there were 26 black quarterbacks in the NFL at the start of the season. More than half of them were starting quarterbacks, something that's never been seen. And there's almost the presumption now that when you watch television on college or pros and you see a black quarterback, you're not pointing like we used to years back and say, I'm supporting the black quarterback, right? Because most of the time now they're on both sides of the ball. That's carried over from college. How do you see that impacting the NFL?
Listen, it's got to be helpful to the progress. I mean, I think nowadays people aren't saying that's a black quarterback. They're saying that's a great quarterback. They're saying that's a quarterback who knows how to lead his team. And I think when that happens at the lower levels, whether it's college, high school, that's just going to produce even more great athletes at that position and great leaders at that position. So it's only got to benefit us.
I think when people get comfortable seeing that number of black people playing the position of quarterback, and like you said, they didn't just start talking about his attributes. I'm wondering if that can carry over into front office positions, GM positions, because we try to look at diversity to say, when have we arrived? When do we not have to keep having the programs? When you think about diversity in the NFL, is there a measuring point where you sort of say we've arrived and we don't have to do it anymore? Do you think it's something we kind of have to stay with?
I think in the short term we need to stay with it because I think there's still more progress to be made ultimately. So I don't intend, and I don't think our team, you know, including Daisha, Jonathan, Troy, have any idea that we're going to slow down what we're doing. I think we continue to look at diversity, whether it's through the ownership or whether it's to, you know, anybody in the football side or the business side of our operations or the league side. So I think we have to continue it because I think there's more to do. And I think the results will show and the league continue to be more successful.
Your programs have been really intentional. There are 8 current black GMs in the league, 5 black team presidents, and 9 minority head coaches in the NFL, a record for any time in the National Football League. James, how do you think that's been impacted perhaps by the quarterback position, if at all?
I think the quarterback's position has created more and more publicity that has built a trust, you know, in our teams, in our fans, and around the country. And with that trust has given us opportunity. I see where we're going from 3 to 6 coaches. We got more general managers. I was a part of the quarterback summit, where we had 3 presidents on the forum. And I was truly impressed with how they could represent their franchises. And we went from 3 to 6 head coaches. So I think we're going in the right directions, but I still think we have some work to do. Yeah. I was looking the other day, and now we don't have any quarterback. We don't have any offensive coordinators. Black offensive coordinators. We have limited number of quarterback coaches. And the head coaches being hired, most of them today are being hired from the quarterback room. We got to get more coaches in the quarterback room. The quarterback summit, supported by Commissioner Rizzell and Troy Vincent, we've identified some young black quarterback coaches. They just need the opportunity. But in order for us to make that a level playing field, we got to get young players in the quarterback room. And it was an initiative that the commissioner and the league came up with last year, where I think every team has to have a black in the quarterback room. And down the line, that would help us. But I think during this offseason, we got to identify some quarterback coaches so when this next hiring cycle come around, that we'll get invited to the party.
One of the things the league did at its expense was to give every team the opportunity to hire two offensive assistant coaches, recognizing that the promotion from offense to coordinator typically comes from the quarterback position. Doug, you have a son that's even in the league who has been an offensive-minded player working to get through that system. How can we help players like your son and other young black players and get more athletes, former players, into coaching so that we can get more black coaches in the quarterback room?
Wow, thanks, Mike, for asking me. I didn't know it was going to come like that, but but you're right. You know, I do have a son that's been in New Orleans for the last 5 years and assistant quarterback coach, and, you know, I've had to deal with the frustration that from him over the last week or so. You know, he's been fortunate enough to have interviews but hadn't landed that job that he, you know, and I do believe that he's capable of doing if given an opportunity. But we all know you got to wait your chances, as they always say. But I got the same feeling as Shaq. You know, from the quarterback standpoint, you know, I'm good with that. I think we're getting better. From the coach's standpoint, we've gotten a lot better. And even from the general manager's standpoint, I think we're moving in the right direction. And then team president, the one area that has slowed down hadn't speeded up yet, is to get that young quarterback in the quarterback room. Because as you know, you look around this league, you know, usually when coordinators hire, they usually have their own guy that they want to work with. And I think the head coaches give them that privilege to do that, and that's their right. But, you know, there's a lot of young quarterbacks, coaches out there that are just waiting on that one opportunity that they give other people. You know, some people say, hey, he's too young. You know, he's 31 years old. How young do you have to be before you get that opportunity, you know? But that's just one of those things, and he's going to keep working. I know he's going to do that. I don't have to worry about that. But that's the one area for me that is my Achilles heels, is that young quarterback coach.
Commissioner, you've been aware of the issue about the black quarterback and coaches, black coaches at the quarterback position. How have you addressed it, and what do you see as possible ways to enhance that progress?
Well, I think, you know, the question you asked Shaq, what did these guys do by their success that has created the success and progress that we've had today, is maybe as limited as it is in certain areas, is they shattered the myth. They shattered the myth that a black quarterback can't lead a team or shouldn't be the face of a team.
Right.
And now you see that. Clubs are very comfortable saying, if that is my head coach, if he's black, I'm totally comfortable with that. Listen, we got to remember, this league's still really competitive. There's only 32 of these jobs as head coaches. And I think in Baltimore, as a matter of fact, I think we have an all-black quarterback room.
Yeah.
Three players, they're playing quarterback, and two coaches. Yeah. Again, another first. But again, we're running out of that. So I think the progress we need to do, I think the offensive assistant will help. But I think we still have to try to give them the opportunities to try to continue to develop quickly, more quickly, and get the opportunities to get those jobs that are going to put them in the position. They can do it.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
And with respect to the presidents, do you feel the same way that owners taking on team presidents and GMs? Is there a sense as well that they're more comfortable seeing people in that position performing in that role?
Absolutely. But again, I want people in the room making all of these decisions, whether it's on ownership, whether it's on coaches, presidents, or it's general managers, or it's the head of your business operations. If the right people in the room making those decisions, they're going to make the right decisions ultimately. And the more diverse that group is, the better we're going to be.
Well, last comments before we close. If you could
add any rule or implement any change or just offer any advice, Shaq, that would continue to promote black quarterbacks, black GMs, black presidents, just fair general diversity hiring within the league in general? What would be the pearls of wisdom you would put out there?
I would think if we want to increase, you know, opportunity for blacks, especially in coaching, I would think one thing we need to do is we need to identify who those coaches are. We need to go to the media when games are being played and the guys are announcing, well, this is a future head coach. And we hear it sometime because some of the owners don't know who the top coaches are.
James Shaq Harris, the first African-American season starting quarterback in NFL history. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. As AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Thank you, John, for this week's program. Next up, we have a commentary from the Black World Media Today.
On the Black World Media Network, this is a commentary from activist and black feminist organizer Jamala Rogers.
I had a range of emotions when I heard about the shooting of Tavion Kuntz Williams in Akron, Ohio. I was so relieved that although he was obviously traumatized, he lived to tell about it. My heart goes out to his family who must now guide him through this traumatic experience. Like any village mother, once you find out they're all right, I wanted to lay into him and ask, what the hell were you thinking? But I paused because this is not just a question of Tavion's nativity. This is about the political and social responsibility of our communities. Notice I said communities, not just the parents. I'm trying to figure out how a black teen in the U.S. hasn't been told about the murder of 12-year-old Tamir Rice just 3 years ago. Tamir was playing with a play gun that belonged to a friend. That friend's father bought the gun for his son. This was and obviously still is a teachable moment. How did we get so disconnected from the primal instinctive force to protect our young? Even the mothers in the animal kingdom prepare their young for the world that they will face. They teach them how to feed themselves, how to defend themselves, basically how to survive. We must teach our young that they cannot do what white kids do in America. I know some may have a problem with me saying that because it is the blackity black truth. When I tell black youth, and sometimes that I do that when I'm taking a toy gun away from them, that they cannot do what white kids do in America, I quickly follow up with, but I'm working really hard so that one day you can play carefree and you can have fun safely. Today is not that day. If we're going to put guns in our children's hands, we must teach them gun ideology along with gun safety and marksmanship. African Village, we must stay woke, especially and obviously in the state of Ohio. We must remember our children are considered collateral damage under racial capitalism. This is Jamala Rogers, your Black feminist organizer, just expressing myself. Thank you for listening.
That was a commentary from activist and Black feminist organizer Jamala Rogers. Stay tuned to the Black World Media Network for pertinent commentaries from the outstanding minds in the global Black diaspora.
Here's Lene.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black. But I'm going to keep it brief. Everybody gather around. It's time for me to call y'all in. Boy, you a fool for this one. I get back on the internet after Lent, praise God, he is risen, to find out y'all got Amanda Seales and Candace Owens in the same sentence. Why? Because apparently for the past 2 weeks, y'all had the nerve to cook up in Amanda Seales' hate train and ride it till the wheels fell off. So let's talk about it. Amanda got on our internet to say thank you to her 2.2 million followers for their support. And that's an important number. Because if not for them, interacting with her content, feeling so compelled by her work to support her independent endeavors emphatically and financially, she wouldn't feel like she was doing shit. And why is that, you ask? Because Amanda Seales has dedicated her life's work to the empowerment, education, liberation, and uplift of all Black people and don't now Black platform recognize her. In fact, she's not even invited. And what did y'all have to say about that? That's what you get. That seems to me a more appropriate response if Candace Owens wanted to be invited to the cookout, but she's being allowed to disseminate shit that she quite literally makes up to massive impressionable audiences via Joe Budden and The Breakfast Club. Let me tell you something. The problem here is twofold. Number one, being likable should not be more important than being good at your job, dearest. When number two, the likability you speak of has more to do with one's ability to operate within the status quo than actually being a good person. And I'm specifically talking to the writer because apparently Essence as an institution has taken steps to remedy this oversight, but the griot gets no love from me. And while she was more so thanking her tribe for validating her work, the internet community felt that she didn't have any room to complain when, in your words, she so plainly likes to rage against the machine she desires to be lauded by. But y'all don't think critically. It's not that she desires to be lauded by the machine, it's that she desires that the machine no longer work to silence and exile voices like hers. But even if that was the case, I don't see how y'all don't see that two things can't be true. We as a community really have to question how much we actually want things to change, or if we really just want to know how much of what currently exists we can get access to while using the we shall overcome rhetoric to get there. Talk to them. Because in what world does pushing the envelope to actually see the same systems change that we write? Oh girl, where have you been? Now, have I ever seen Amanda Seales in action in any of these rooms she's been rumored to purposely be excluded from? No. But what I do know is that activism exists on the spectrum. And because every level of activism is revolutionary in the time it's introduced, every period is going to call for another level of it. However, because times change, but the people who benefit from systems do not, this also means that different levels of activism must coexist at the same time. So yeah, as ineffective as it may seem to Gen Z, we do need those people who are simply representative faces that play the game. We need those people who are sleuthing their way up through the ranks to snatch a seat at the table. Sure, we need people willing to navigate likability and speaking up strategically, but we also need the people who exist at the fringes of likability, coasting on discomfort that speak loudly and unabashedly about the shit that's simply not okay. We need them all together, concurrently, and all the above need the Amandas of this world who are living and breathing reminders of and barometers for the shit we cannot accept. And us, knowing historically how crucial figures like this are, how dare we make her feel alone? We saw it in the Shirley Chisholm movie. Being alone and revolutionary is simply not sustainable. How is it that Black people at large still can't seem to recognize women for their much-needed activism until they're dead and gone? Because they weren't palatable. Oh, but she said this and she did that one time. She's doing much more good than harm. So how dare we search for a clapback instead of taking just as much accountability as we're asking her to as her community? Instead, we engage exactly what they want us to, and that's victim blaming. They are counting on us to ostracize one another. They are counting on us to get access and thrive on likability, so much so that we would rather protect our own likability than each other. Louder for the people in the VIP! And look, people also need time to evolve. You can be very aware that certain behavior won't get you popularity points, and then have a different emotion about it when the full weight of it hits you. We have to find new ways to call each other in, especially the ones going to bat for us, positioning themselves as sacrificial lambs so the work gets done. The fact that Amanda is willing to put her career, reputation, relationships on the line for the right message is honorable. And y'all love Dr. Umar for it. Y'all respect Charlemagne for it. Matter of fact, you go to bat for both of them. Hell, even just hilarious. And not saying that these people have the right messages, but they're following is proof that contrary, polarizing beliefs and attitudes can't be tolerated and protected. I guess that just goes out the window when it comes to making the world a better place. Why? Because truth be told, palatability is respectability fashioned off the whims and influences of the men and or white folks we are either employed by or want to impress. And it's insanely difficult to be a Black woman with sense, a woman with an informed or educated opinion in this world, or albeit a woman that's simply capable. Angel Reese isn't a sympathetic character, though nobody expects male athletes to be that way. But when she does show some emotion, Now she's a hypocrite. I'm not saying Beyonce isn't talented. I just don't like her. What is it that y'all want from black women? And why is it that we have to be liked for anything we do to be considered, consumed, and celebrated? And not even that. What makes us unlikable and disposable when y'all give literal rapists, abusers, sex traffickers, and malignant narcissists a chance to prove you wrong every time, even when the evidence is damning?
And finally, folks, I want to remind you once again that next week on Ebony Spectrum, in the studio, we will have Professor Etta Fields Black talking about her book on Harriet Tubman. And finally, in our last segment today, we have something of a current importance from Roland Martin. See you next week. Take care.
The Supreme Court heard arguments on how the Justice Department used a law enacted by Congress against the January 6th insurrectionists. If the justices decide to toss out this particular charge, it could legally impact hundreds of rioters involved in the attack on the U.S. Capitol. During today's hearing, Justice Brett Kavanaugh questioned why the DOJ charged some January 6th rioters with obstructing an official proceeding, which could carry more prison time. Listen.
There's six other counts in the indictment here, which include civil disorder, physical contact with the victim, assault, entering and remaining in a restricted building, disorderly and disruptive conduct, disorderly conduct in the Capitol building. And why aren't those six counts good enough just from the Justice Department's perspective, given that they don't have any of the hurdles?
Because those counts don't fully reflect the culpability of petitioner's conduct on January 6th. Those counts do not require that petitioner have acted corruptly to obstruct an official proceeding. And obviously, petitioner committed other crimes that we've charged and that we're seeking to hold him accountable for. But one of the distinct strands of harm, one of the root problems with petitioner's conduct is that he knew about that proceeding. He had said in advance of January 6th that he was prepared to storm the Capitol, prepared to use violence. He wanted to intimidate Congress. He said they can't vote if they can't breathe. And then he went to the Capitol on January 6th with that intent in mind and took action, including assaulting a law enforcement officer, that did impede the ability of the officers to regain control of the Capitol and let Congress finish its work in that session. And I think it is entirely appropriate for the government to seek to hold petitioner accountable for that conduct.
Joining us right now is Ellie Mistel, the justice correspondent for The Nation. Ellie, glad to have you here. Oh, okay, Ellie, so this is where I am a wee bit confused. So to hear Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, first of all, has Brett Kavanaugh ever been a prosecutor?
No, I don't believe so. He's been a political hack. He worked for Ken Starr. I don't think he's ever been a prosecutor, but I'm not 100% sure.
So a guy who's never been a prosecutor wants to question, why did you had these six charters, why do you need this one? I'm sorry, I don't recall somebody asking a prosecutor, hey, why did you hit them with 10 charges? 8 was sufficient.
Yeah, so what Kavanaugh is doing right there is that he's basically saying, haven't we prosecuted these people enough? Haven't these patriots and tourists been through enough? Why do you have to charge them with this extra charge, too? He's arguing that the Department of Justice is overcharging people, which is something that Brett Kavanaugh and the rest of the conservatives never do when the defendants are black, right? They never do it when the defendants are Latino. They're never worried about the Justice Department overcharging, over-prosecuting, going too hard against defendants who are of color. But now that white MAGA insurrectionists are feeling the rough end of the Department of Justice, suddenly Kavanaugh is like, no, 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 these other charges are enough. These extra charges, and remember what we're talking about here, the obstruction of Congress charge, that's for the people who went into the Capitol looking for Mike Pence, looking for Nancy Pelosi, looking for the electoral ballots, trying to literally stop them from certifying the election. Over 1,000 people have been charged in connection with January 6th, just for the people who broke in and defecated all over the place and acted like fools, right? These charges are for the 300 or so that we think were really trying to disrupt the function of the American government. And Kavanaugh is saying, no, that's going too far. You're hurting these people too much.
Amazing, because these people actually said it. They actually said, we're going to stop this. So they made it clear that they were looking to stop impeding them from doing their job. They were kind of clear.
These are the people with the zip ties. These are the people, again, as Solicitor General Liz Prelogger said in the clip that you played, this is the guy, the name defendant in this case, this is the guy who said they can't vote if they can't breathe. What is that, right? So what the government did is they used this obstruction charge that came out of the Enron stuff, all right? And that's where the complication comes, right? This is, if people remember Enron, huge scandal. They did various things to obstruct Congress investigating that scandal, including destroying documents and whatever. And after the Enron scandal was kind of prosecuted, what the government realized is that Enron was kind of using a loophole, right? Previous obstruction charges, like you needed a very specific thing. And so put like this, when you have too much specificity, there are loopholes, there are gaps. And so in the Enron situation, Congress created this catch-all provision. That's what we're really talking about here, a catch-all provision to count obstructions of official proceedings, obstructions of Congress, even if they're not specifically named by whatever Congress thinks of that day, right? So it's a fallback position to catch people who obstruct Congress in a way that maybe you haven't thought of before, right? So when the justices, Thomas, Alito, even John Roberts today, started kind of complaining that, well, the government has never used this before in this situation, Prelogger, the Solicitor General, responded, I think, accurately with, well, ain't nobody ever tried to attack the Capitol before.
Right! I mean, why are you using this? It's the same thing. Oh, Colorado, why are you kicking him off the ballot? Oh, because, let's see, we never had a president try this.
Right? This has literally never happened before. And this specific provision in the law was meant to catch things that had never happened before. So it's kind of a direct on-point application and use of the law. But because it hurts white folks, because it hurts, you know, certain people's wives, because it implicates people that the conservative justices like, now they don't want to use this charge. And I'll just bring her back around, because I know you talked about this yesterday, and it's important to me as well. Think about what they did yesterday to DeRay, right? To DeRay McKesson, who did not start a riot, did not throw rocks at any officers, did not have anything to do with the people who were injured in the protests that the government is concerned about. Oh, for them, the Supreme Court can use every stitch of law, every trumped up, never used before operation of law to try to go hunt DeRay, because they don't like DeRay. So they're trying to get DeRay. And so the Supreme Court says, that's fine. But then when you try to extend and use a law specifically designed to implicate the times that we haven't thought of yet, no, now that's going too far. Why isn't what we charge them with already enough, according to the conservative Supreme Court justices?
So Clarence Thomas is sitting there as a part of this. He's married to a woman who was fully supportive of January 6th. That man should not even be near the bench.
Look, I don't know why he's there. Like, you get to a point where, like, if y'all are comfortable with this level of open corruption, I don't know what to tell you, right? Because just as an interesting note, Clarence Thomas was absent from the court yesterday. Yesterday, they were doing a corruption hearing, basically about a public official who had taken gifts in exchange for official acts. Clarence Thomas ain't nowhere to be found yesterday. He was still on his RV. He was still out on his yacht with Harlan Gray. He didn't want no part of yesterday's argument, right? But today, he's back on the job, sitting there to defend insurrectionists like his wife. The simple fact that Clarence Thomas's wife could have, and I would argue, should have been charged along with the very insurrectionists that Thomas now says shouldn't be charged at all, should disqualify him from this case. And the fact that that isn't kind of like a top line media story, the fact that that's not going to be talked about in like the New York Times report about this case tomorrow, it's infuriating. And I don't know how to get the country kind of to appreciate just how disgusting this is, just how lawless this is. And I don't know how to get politicians to understand that you need an entirely new ethics code with real teeth to stop this from, to stop, and by this I mean Clarence Thomas, to stop Clarence Thomas and people like him from ever happening again.
Well, what's also interesting is that he actually, I love this part where he was like, well, is this really that big of a deal? Because weren't they just, you know, doing what people do when they shout out in the middle of a proceeding?
Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch all made analogies to the January 6th protesters as if they were hecklers, right? Like, well, if you can prosecute them for obstructing Congress for January 6th, couldn't you prosecute a heckler who disrupted this courtroom's proceedings? That was
A heckler who decided to come out of their seat and run up to a member of Congress and in doing so knock a cop out and then make a beeline for the member of Congress or the city council member. You're right. That's the kind of heckler.
Right? Again, Solicitor General Prelogger had the right answer to that, and her answer was basically like, no, that's not the same, because that heckler isn't making you people run for your lives. And that's what she said straight up to them, right? But the justices didn't care. Neil Gorsuch had a particularly annoying analogy, because he was like, isn't the January 6th protesters just like, I don't know, pulling a fire alarm during an official proceeding, obviously trying to throw some shade at my congressman and my man, Jamal Bowman, who accidentally pulled a fire alarm in the Capitol. They always like to make a big thing about that on Fox News. So Neil Gorsuch referenced the fire alarm, not Jamal Bowman my name, but you know who he was talking about, in Supreme Court oral arguments today, analogizing what Bowman did to, again, the rioters who attack the Capitol with guns and zip ties and bear spray, looking to do things like, I don't know, hang Vice President Mike Pence. Like, that was the analogy that Neil Gorsuch thought was cool to make today. I said it online. You got to understand that these conservative justices are basically everybody's white racist uncle who just sits at home all day watching Fox News and then thinks that the world is what Fox News tells them it is. Like, that's who these people are, and you saw it today in horrible stark relief.
That's absolutely crazy. Ellie Mestel, anything else that jumped out at you that just had you almost pulling your hair out to a flat top?
I mean, obviously this case is going to be 6-3 at least. I could even see 7-2. Some of the liberals were a little bit interested in the thing. I don't think it ultimately affects the Trump prosecution. Trump is being charged with obstruction of Congress. The charges are different for him because, like, he's literally had fake documents that he was trying to submit to obstruct Congress, which is a little bit more like the Enron thing than less like the Enron thing. So I don't think that it affects the Jack Smith case against him. The problem with that, of course, is that the Supreme Court has an entirely different way to defend Trump from Jack Smith. And we're going to hear that next week, next Thursday, when the Supreme Court hears Trump.
Thank you, Roland and Ellie. We got cut off at the end there, but folks understand where they were coming from. Finally, last but not least, let's go back to Tennessee again.
It is really hard, even as a new mom, to stand here and have to be composed on a piece of legislation that I know put my son's life at risk. And before I get to why this bill is bad, Mr. Speaker, I am also disappointed, Mr. Speaker, that I saw a lot of my colleagues, not all, but many here laughing at the mothers being put out like it's funny. I am very offended by many of my colleagues on this floor. because we are now in the process of debating what I consider one of the most dangerous pieces of legislation to come out of this legislative assembly. Guys, this is irresponsible. The public school teachers don't even want the bill. They're not even asking you for this. We just passed legislation to have SROs in every school. Can we see if that works yet? I'm upset, not out of because I don't like you all individually, because I'm mad because this bill puts my child at risk. And all the mothers out here that just got put out, they're saying their children at risk. Look at that gallery. They're asking you not to do this. Put partisan politics aside. I ask you this all the time, but this bill is dangerous. Don't do it. You know, I had a lot of points that I brought up in Judiciary Committee that I was going to stay. But what recently took place just put me in a real bad space, Mr. Speaker. I'm not even going to lie to you that I'm not hurt and disappointed. So I'm just going to take this opportunity to speak to from the heart on behalf of all the mothers who were just put out the gallery. We are literally talking about arming educators who took an oath to give teach our kids writing and arithmetic and how they can one day contribute to Tennessee's great economy, and we're now turning them to law enforcement agents by arming them with guns. We think this piece of legislation is going to keep kids safe, which is probably going to enable the next school shooter. And it's not going to be someone coming in from the outside. It's unfortunately going to be a teacher with this piece of legislation. So this is my problem with the bill. First and foremost, this bill establishes a permitting process to carry a gun, a process we won't even give every citizen the ability to go through in this state. We're making these teachers know how to use guns and going through a permitting process, the background check process, essentially a system we had in place that we took away. Now we want to bring it back because it's coming into schools. We don't even create safe environments outside of the school building. Secondly, we already have a problem with youth popping cars in all our cities across the state. What makes you think they're not going to pop a desk and take a gun? Use common sense. Common sense. Literally putting guns in the hands of individuals who are not even law enforcement agents. They don't even have the training for true de-escalation, as if they go through these sorts of situations every day. Thirdly, let's not even talk about mass shooters. Let's put that to the side. Let's talk about some issues that's going on in urban core that goes on in my school district, about gang violence that goes on in school. Say, for example, two gentlemen, 6'4", 6'5", ninth grade, probably the size that my own son would be. He's anticipated to be well over 6 feet. They get into an argument in the classroom. You got a teacher who's standing 5'6". We know she can't break up the fight, so she pulls out the gun and shoot because she feels scared when two guys on the football team having a disagreement in the classroom. And because the SRO officer can't get there enough, she feels like she's unable to pull out a gun to break up a simple fight. That is going to happen with this bill. And what if she decides to shoot that kid? Those same kids get into a fight. They know that teacher got a gun. They pop the desk and take out the gun and shoot the other kid. Don't think it won't happen. Teachers are already getting their guns and belongings stolen out the parking lot of schools. Do you think it won't happen in the school building? Guys, this is irresponsible. Teachers don't want it. The school districts don't want it. Nobody doesn't want it. It's not going to work. It's going to cause more school shootings. I ask that we legislate with common sense. What happened today is a gallery full of mothers who are concerned, and we put them out because you're trying to put guns in teachers' hands. We ought to be ashamed, Mr. Speaker. That's unacceptable. And Mr. Speaker, I ask my colleagues if they care about the children, if we are really pro-life, like we claim to be in this state, I ask that you don't put our children's lives at risk by putting more and more guns in schools when guns are the leading cause of death for children in Tennessee. Let's not increase those rates. Let's change the statistics and let's do some smart legislation that actually keeps kids safe. Thank you.
That is another thing that's going on and around the country. And Rick and I urgently ask you to check out what's going on in your community. Pennsylvanians, you have a election coming up on Tuesday. Don't forget to go vote for your choice. And don't get fooled by the okey-doke. We'll check you out next week, finally. And you have a safe and peaceful week. Take care.
I just got a text asking me to approve a bank transfer I didn't make. I bet you get messages like this too. So much of our lives are online today, from email to banking and everything in between. To make sure my information was protected, I checked out CISA's Secure Our World website for simple steps to stay safe online. Now I know how to protect myself from scammers, and you can learn too. Go to CISA at cisa.gov/secureourworld.
Yeah. Hey, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Got some can in the background. It's 7 o'clock. It's time for the radio calendar. The radio calendar? Sure. Anyway, here are some things going on in our fair city. The Pittsburgh Center for Arts and Media will host a plein air paint out on April 20th and 21st. The two-day event will take place from 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. on Saturday and 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. on Sunday. Ein plein air is a French expression that I don't know how to say properly, but it means in the open air and is used to describe the art of painting outdoors. This new event will utilize the Mellon Park campus to celebrate the art of painting outdoors. The plein air painting experience will be guided by local artists Tyler Gedman and Joshua Hoffman, who will be available throughout both days for questions and advice. Information and registration for April 20th and 21st is available at pghartsmedia.org/catalog/course. While you're at the Pittsburgh Center for Arts and Media, you should check out an exhibition with artist Ron Copeland titled The Story of the Blissfield General Store and the Pure Bliss Advertising Campaign. Ron Copeland explores his great-grandfather W.W. Moore's history of owning the local general store in a small farming town named Blissfield. The town sprung up in the 1890s. When the Pennsylvania Railroad extended a commuter and freight line through the Sleepy Ohio Valley. As America shifted away from the rails and into the driver's seat of the automobile, Busfield was cut off from its lifeline. The show is on display now through June 2nd at PCA&M, which is located at 1047 Shady Avenue in Shadyside. Again, more information is available at pghartsmedia.org. Liberty Magic presents History of Magic Part 1, a sketch comedy show featuring magic, singing, stage combat, sideshow, and more. To satirize magic from its birth in 2700 BC all the way up to modern day. Written by and starring two performers who happen to be chaotically good friends and partners in crime, Hayden Alcorn and Nathan Fan. They have performed separately on TV shows, cruise ships, and stages across the globe, and are uniting to team up for a show that they've been working on for over 5 years. History of Magic Part 1 is presented now through May 12th at Liberty Magic, which is located at 803 Liberty Avenue in downtown Pittsburgh. More information is available at trustarts.org. And you can stop by the Pittsburgh Banjo Club's regular rehearsal every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to enjoy their wonderful music and perhaps have a snack and or a drink. Founded in 1988, the Pittsburgh Banjo Club is an all-volunteer band and organization that uses banjos, trumpets, tubas, and bass to perform popular music from the 1920s and 1930s. The Pittsburgh Banjo Club rehearses at the Allegheny Elks Lodge number 339. Which is located at 400 Cedar Avenue in Pittsburgh's North Side. Reservations must be made by Tuesday at 5 p.m. for each Wednesday event. You can do that by giving them a call, 412-321-1834. Moving on to more live music happening in our city tonight. At Preserving Underground, you can catch Wrist Meets Razor, along with the Requiem and Silenus. Pacing will be at the Roboto Project, along with Copeland James, Frame and Mantle, and Dewey Decibel System. Club Cafe is hosting Scott H. Byram, along with Adrian and Meredith. Dear Nora and Gina Gorey will be at